Session number 10691, Reel 1.
Mrs. Natton, Reel 1. Now, I know that you were very young when the fall of Singapore occurred, but can you tell me what you can remember from it in as much detail as you can?
Certainly. Initially, we were living in Kuala Lumpur with my grandparents, who were of Dutch descent. My father's Irish, my mother's Dutch. It's quite a mixed family. I was about 3.5 years old at the time, and we were moved from Kuala Lumpur across the causeway down to Singapore, and we were in Shell House for about a month. Then we realised that we had to get on the ship because my father had become quite anxious. There had been considerable bombing. Relatives were at the time being killed because they were venturing out into the streets of Singapore, sometimes in quite an agitated state. In fact, one of my aunts, a Chinese lady called Molly, she couldn't stand the confinement of the air raid shelter and actually went out into the open, and of course she was killed. Out of the shelter, and of course she was killed in the streets of Singapore. My father happened to go out after her, holding down her husband, who was obviously very agitated at the time. And he then put a blanket over her because she was not in a very pretty state. The troops came by at the time in a lorry and they were going to take her away. And all my father did was take a blanket or take a gunny sack, rucksack, and put it on top of her. And her body was taken away just like that. And the soldiers then advised, or the troops advised my father, there are ships coming tomorrow. Please get out of this city, get onto the ships. All I can remember is being part and parcel of a very hectic, mad crowd with people lining the whole of the wharf with suitcases and luggage. The amount of suitcases some of them had was absolutely incredible, whilst we had very little on us at all. And being caught up in the mad rush of trying to get on this ship, and the grown-ups to a child look very, very big indeed and very large and frightening. And I can remember my father pushing us on. I can also remember my grandfather going further and further away into the distance and waving, because I was the apple of his eye, and saying, I'll see you sometime. And we were on the ship. My father wasn't on the ship. We were there with quite a number of other relatives, and several hours out into the sea, and our ship was bombed. The ship was a Qualla. It was in the main just a little old vessel, carrying quite a number of women and children, Red Cross nurses as well. And despite the fact that it had a Red Cross flag, they bombed us. There were quite a number of kind things that happened to us on the ship. We didn't have any food, but there was a Chinese lady who saw how hungry I was, and she came over to my mother, and she said, here, Missy, take this for your child. And there were quite a number of arrogant glances as to why is this person being singled out for special treatment. But it was just a kindly gesture from somebody who perhaps had known the family or knew of the family, because whilst we were old colonials, we didn't treat the servants or the people very badly at all. In fact, my grandfather was very, very well respected. We had a very good name in the area. And it was purely one of those untimely gestures that helped to keep me alive, or helped to satisfy a child's hunger, and we were very grateful for that, because she had her own children, and yet she had indeed come over to us and said, here, have some rice. And then Mum looked around and realised that she was getting some hostile glances on the ship, and said, I think we'd better go down and look for the others. Now, on board the ship also, very close to us, was Auntie Sybil and her three children, and various other people were just flung all over the ship, and you were virtually walking over each other. And Mum said, I think I'll go down and try and find Sybil, Sally Ann and William. When the bomb came, it came very suddenly, and I can remember screaming and shouting, absolute panic. My mother was climbing down, and her skirt was ripped away by the shock of the blast, and she was a little bit embarrassed. But people were just wanting to get away from the fire and the sinking ship. So Mum said to me, we were going to get upstairs. I can remember my Aunt Sybil, who was a very, very beautiful lady, I do have a picture of her, shouting out and having words with my mother, which turned out to be, please, somebody help me. I've got three, you've only got one. Someone help me with the other children. And it was almost as though you were looking at it, but were also removed from it. And Mum turned round to Sybil and said, I can't, I've got my daughter. And Sybil turned round and cried and she said, oh God, you men never hear when you want them. Which is quite an instinctive reaction. And the captain was, or the head of the vessel was coming around and was saying, you've got to jump. Mum doesn't swim. And she was absolutely terrified. But he said, look, I'm sorry, you've got to go down. And cousins were being blasted right, left and centre. One got half her body just shot off. And another was injured so badly she didn't even realise that she was that badly injured. And she looked down and saw herself bleeding. And she died a few moments after that. It was a very closed environment in Kuala Lumpur and Singapore at the time. And the people that you socialised with were, and the people on the ship were very well known to you. And it was very sad seeing people go down in this manner. But it couldn't be helped. The head of the vessel came to my mother and said, well, you've got to get off the ship, you'll go down. And Mum said, I'm terrified. But she, because of course I had no life jacket and she couldn't swim, but the captain insisted and said, well, look, I'm sorry, I've got to do my duty, I don't want you dead. If you don't jump, I'm going to push you. So Mum turned around to me and she said, put your arms around me, cling tight, and we'll jump. And we did. And she was very kind. Because towards the end, she was wondering because she had no life jacket. And a gentleman threw a life jacket to us just on the spur of the moment. It was a child's life jacket. And Mum put it round me. We jumped. And in the water, there were lots of bodies floating about us. The water was quite cold, surprisingly, for a hot country. And it just kept that life jacket that someone had flung through the goodness of his heart, kept my mother and myself in the water. There was an awful lot of screaming, an awful lot of panic. This is the first time I've spoken about it to anybody. And we just kept alive in the water and kept afloat. There were people just going down, someone going crazy, calling out for taxis in the water. It was almost as though chaos reigned. My mum kept saying, keep quiet, keep calm, we'll be okay. And the vessel started getting away from us. There were people splashing about in the water. And then all of a sudden, from this awful noise, there was just calm, it seemed, and a lengthy calm. And then Mum heard somebody call out, and Amina, which is my mother's nickname, because she's Wilhelmina, and it was one of our cousins, Millie Hatton. Okay. Millie Hatton called out to us. Her legs had been shell-shocked. Millie died fairly recently in Australia, at the age of about 97. So she suggested that as I had the life jacket, we might be in the water a long time. So would I please put my legs, would Mummy put her legs on Millie's shell-shocked legs, and with my life jacket, perhaps we could stay afloat in the water a little longer. Which actually happened, but we were in the water for a very long time, and afternoon went by, evening came, and twilight descends rather rapidly, or sunset descends rather rapidly in the Far East. And Mum turned round and said, we're not going to be helped, Millie. And I said, no, we are going to be safe, we're not going to die. And I started to sing. I've always had a fairly good voice. I started to sing, and all sorts of things, and then I fell asleep. Then I woke up several hours later. Mum, Millie and I were still floating. There were funny animals in the water, or sharks, I think, people going by you, still floating. And all of a sudden I saw this vessel on the horizon, and I said, look, Jesus has sent a boat. Was a little sampan, a fishing boat. And there were about five people on board, including a Dr. Lyons, and they dragged us out of the water. And we travelled, we put on the boat, on the little sampan, and we were taken to an island where there was a fisherman or head of the village who took us in and gave us comfort for the night. I was apparently quite badly shaken. I was running a temperature. I can remember being in that fishing village with the water lapping under me and eating fish and rice. And I can also remember them putting saffron on me. I don't know why they chose saffron, perhaps to bring the fever down. But it was then agreed that we should travel by night, liaise with as many of the survivors as we possibly could, and go on to try to get to a place whereby we could meet up with friends and secure some freedom. The headman of the village, I don't know his name, was absolutely excellent to us, and he actually dressed me in peasant clothes because my hair had been bleached by the sun. I was very fair. And we travelled by night from island to island under cover of darkness, and they had a very, very cleverly arranged system whereby they would call out something in Malay, a password, and if they got the correct response, then obviously they would land and we would be taken again ashore rather secretly and cared for until the next sampan picked us up and took us to another place. Eventually, on perhaps it must have been a couple of weeks at least, they didn't dare keep us in any one place for too long because people would talk, there might be spies around. And there was one particular meeting that didn't go off quite well because someone must have given away the fact that we were travelling. We were only a very, very small group, about five or six people. And the signal wasn't the right one. And we landed right in the hands of the Japanese. They shot the poor Malay gentleman who was actually looking after us. And we were taken ashore, and then we found that there were other relatives there. The whole place had been divided into two camps, and there seemed to be no sense into why they were hoarding people together and separately. It was just one great big area, rather like a canton or an encampment. And there was wire. And there seemed to be, again, no sense in why we were put in the particular place that we were put in. All of a sudden, my mother recognised another relative, and that was Aunt Millie. So she had, Sybil, she had made it, but she had two of the children with her. The baby, little Richard, had gone down. In fact, we learnt much later that his body had been found floating in the water. In fact, somebody had picked him up and then had to actually put him back into the sea again because there was no sense in taking along a dead body. What happened next was that Sybil called out Mina, and there was a sort of tearful reconciliation, but across barbed wire. And then again, for no reason, the Japanese always seemed to be rather volatile. And someone somewhere had made a decision which involved all of us. And then the men came with machine guns, and one lot were just mowed down with machine guns. We don't know why we were left. There again seemed to be no logic. It could be perhaps that they had... the only logic was that they only had enough room on the trucks for a certain amount of people. It could be perhaps that Sybil was an encumbrance with two small children and might not be able to work. Perhaps the fact that Mum had only one child, myself, was a motivating factor. To this day, we don't know. There's no rhyme or reason. But they just machine gunned the whole lot down. And they put us onto lorries and we were taken from camp to camp.
Can you actually remember the machine guns?
Yes, I can remember the machine guns. It's surprising what you can remember when you're young. It was horrific. And yet it didn't really get to you then as how horrific it was, because it was almost like looking at a film, looking at a situation that wasn't real. All you can remember is these little men marching about and shouting at you. And you just did whatever you were told in order to stay alive. And we were put in these great big lorries. To this day, I hate lorries. And we were put on them, and we went from camp to camp, meeting up with other prisoners, walking. And eventually, more than a year later, we ended up in a place called Bangkinang, which is right in the heart of Sumatra.
How do you spell
it? Right on the equator. Bangkinang, Bangkinang. Initially, we were put in a convent in Singapore. I don't know the name of the convent, and neither does Mother. But there was a degree of rivalry amongst the people who were there, but that was understandable in the situation. Suffice to say that we came out alive, and that was the main thing. But the part that I remember most vividly was the time that we spent in Bankinam, because I couldn't speak, I lost command of the English language, which is my native tongue, because we were with so many Dutch, I could speak only Dutch. So I think even my mother and I conversed in Dutch, although she's forgotten all of her Dutch, and I've forgotten a lot of it now, but still remember parts of it. We were not allowed an education because the Japanese would not allow it. We had some nuns who said, right, we think your children ought to be educated. And they came, they took down the board. The nuns were absolutely marvellous. The sisters were marvellous. And there was an Australian doctor called Dr. Lyons who performed the most wonderful operation, the most terrible circumstances. She was very tiny, rather like a man, very clipped, very precise, Australian. And she was absolutely wonderful.
Where did the nuns come from?
The nuns came, I think, the nuns were Dutch. So I would have thought from one of the houses in, initially Singapore. Goodness knows exactly what happened in the Far East. But they were obviously from convents. I don't mean to be deprecating at all. They were absolutely wonderful. And they looked after us. In fact, I was baptised originally Church of England. But my mother was so impressed by what they did. And she determined that should anything happen to her, that I would survive and I'd be looked after by the nuns. And because also of an internal conflict with a member, with the head of the Church of England, or one of the representatives of the Church of England, there was a dispute. And my mother said, I'm not going to let you look after my child. These things happen in a war situation. And she had me baptised a Roman Catholic, and I have my card to this day. On the date, I was baptised Roman Catholic in December of 1945. Because my mother thought that they would at least look after me. We didn't have any Red Cross parcels, we didn't have any correspondence or news from people outside. The British contingent were very small compared with the others. They were mainly Dutch, some Eurasian, some Indians, a lot of Tamils and Chinese and Malays. And we were kept within this final place, which had a wire around it and a wall, because the Japanese made even us work, even the children worked. She did an awful lot of fighting. They made us go and tend their gardens. If anyone committed an offence, we were made to stand out in the sun for very long periods, which seemed rather unfair. But every day my mother said to me, look, we're going to make it. So apparently in the shelter, my grandfather had said to her, life is like a river. We're here, we've got to get over there. And we're going to make it to the other side. And thanks to her, we did. She had at one time said to my grandfather, many, many years ago, I'm never going to this, I'm never going to that. She was one of the social butterflies. But she broke down one day when she was cleaning the lavatories, because she remembered her father's words. She was very close to my grandfather. And the work that they put upon the women was absolutely unbearable. There was one incident whereby the Japanese came into us one day and they wanted to choose girls to take away with them. They wanted comfort girls. But we had some very pretty girls with us, not just English girls, not British, some very pretty girls. So Dr. Lyons, and there was an American journalist called Billy Wybrow, who took the surname of Wybrow because she didn't want to know that she was an American, because the Japanese were more anti-American than they were perhaps anti-British. And her name really was Amelia Wilson-Heyer. And she had been covering the Sino-Japanese War and, of course, had just been caught right in the middle of everything. And she took the name of this British friend of hers purely for protection. And that's why we called her Billy Wybrow. The small group of women in the camp intervened and we hid the young girls because they wanted virgins. They didn't want mother. She was quite safe. And they hid the virgins. And, of course, when the Japanese came in and wondered why there weren't any young people there, they got very angry and they wanted volunteers because they didn't want to let down the head of the commanding officer or whatever. There were a group of Indonesian prostitutes and Malay prostitutes who finally got up and said, well, look, it's just another job to us, let us go. But the Japanese weren't satisfied that wasn't enough for them. And so some of the Dutch ladies, big strapping ladies, volunteered. Hours later, we saw the same truck that had taken these women out come back, and it seemed that the Dutch women had stopped the trucks. They were really muscular big women, and they had beaten up the drivers and had driven the trucks back to the camp, and we all sat there waiting and wondering what was going to happen to us. But I think the Japanese were too embarrassed to admit that they'd been actually beaten up by women. And we didn't hear any more about it. They didn't get the girls. Those who wanted to go obviously went for whatever reasons they wanted to or needed to. No one made any judgments in a situation like that. I think the most important factor was staying alive. So the many, many acts of heroism. I had an accident whereby my mother told me that my father was in the moon, to keep the idea of my father always with me, because we didn't know what had happened. And I fell into a cauldron of boiling hot water. I don't know how I did that, or not rise. And I was going to die. And my mother sat for hours and hours, passive resistance, in the Kanto, which is the commanding officer's hut, with a blanket over me. And she sat there for hours, pleading to go to the Dutch hospital, because, of course, I could speak Dutch. And they said, well, we'll send you to the Malay. Mum said, you're wasting your time, because she doesn't speak Malay, she speaks Dutch. And they said, why, aren't the Malays good enough for you? And Mum said, no, it isn't that at all. It's just that she speaks Dutch, they will understand what she's saying. So she refused to go, and she just sat there. In fact, Billy Wybrow urged her on and said, look, Mina, you've got to sit here and fight for your daughter's life. So Mum just sat outside that hut for hours and hours and hours. And they tried to kick her out, she wouldn't move. They tried to spit on her, she wouldn't move. All sorts of things. She sat there very silent. And eventually a great big ugly gentleman came along and asked her what she was doing and what she wanted. And Mum just took the sheet off and showed my third degree burns. And he got the dose, which is little carriage, and had me sent to the Dutch hospital. And the nurses and doctors are waiting there, and they remonstrated with mother for not having sent me there sooner. But as soon as Mum sort of passed me over, mother collapsed, and they got me just in the nick of time. I was in the hospital for quite a while, and mother wasn't allowed to see me because obviously there had to be skin grafts done without anaesthetic. But they were very, very good, looked after me excellently. And whilst mother wasn't allowed to see me, occasionally she was allowed to come and stand outside the window and just call out to say hello, which was a very good thing between mother and child, because they knew that somebody was out there waiting for you. I healed miraculously and wonderfully, and they were just about to let me out, but an earthquake came. There were lots of earthquakes there, and the children's potties got mixed up, and then of course I had diarrhea and dysentery, and so I stayed in there a bit longer. All sorts of things happened. I had lots of fights with the young Dutch boys and girls there, because there seemed to be some sort of animosity, although I could speak the language fluently. There seemed to be this idea that perhaps the Dutch were, in some instances, mind you, this was only a childish situation. And I had this recollection of climbing right to the top of the wall, because every so often the Japanese would go hunting, and they would go hunting for wild pig. And it was Barbie Chilang. And I only thought of food because I was so desperately hungry. And I climbed onto the wall and announced the fact they were bringing in wild boar. And perhaps we'd have some meat, perhaps. And two boys called Volta and Vimitra, they pulled me right down from the wall and I just fell. And everybody thought I was dead. But for some unknown reason, they just let me lie. The Dr. Lyons apparently got hold of my mother and said, don't move, just leave her where she is. And Mum was going to rush to me, because apparently children are quite flexible and quite relaxed. And the fact that I got up and walked was an absolute miracle to them. But somehow we survived. The main problem was hunger. You were so terribly hungry. And there was an instance where there was a mango tree not too far from where we were, and Mum got incensed with the idea, with the fact that children were going to go hong or hong or hong, meaning hungry. And she said, well, I don't care what they do to me, I'm going to get some food for the children. So she climbed the tree, and there was a lady called Kita Homa standing underneath, who was standing guard and started singing, Mina, there is a Japanese gentleman down here and he's got a gun. So Mum was brought down from the tree, and the Japanese gentleman said to her, what are you doing up the tree? And Mum said, I was trying to get food. Some just picked some fruit for the children. The children are very hungry. And he said, no, you were spying. And Mum said, no, I really was honestly just trying to get some food for the children. Here are the mangoes. You can't see children go hungry. They're so thin and so ill. But he got Mum against warning. He was going to shoot her. By this time, there was pandemonium. And again, timing seems to have played a very operative part in our life, because he was about to shoot Mum. And he said, Bomo, Bomo, shoot. And I ran up to Mother and grabbed her around the legs. And then again, timing, an officer came along and said, you know, what's happening? And Mum explained the situation. He said, well, you have committed a crime. You must be shot. Then he saw me and he said, whose child is that? Mum said, it's my daughter. So the officer intervened and he said, no, this time we will let it go, but you mustn't do it again. The next day they cut down the mango tree. So there was no chance of that episode being repeated. Hunger, again, was the main thing, because we had during the day a State Express 555 can, full can of tin of cooked, not raw rice for the adults and half for the children, and virtually anything you could grab hold of. Towards the end, you were picking grass. If when we children were sent to work and the guards attend the Japanese gardens, Mum did say, well, it's all right, you can steal. So I used to steal from their garden to put something in my knickers to take back, anything that was green. Mum by this time had grown quite resourceful. A lot of people would end up digging or rummaging through the Japanese dustbins, because even eggshells that they didn't want, my mother would take and put in the coal fires to make into some calcium, because she remembered that children need calcium. So she would powder it down for me and make me swallow it whether I liked it or not, because she said, you've got to have some calcium for your bones later on.
Did the Japanese ever carry out any kind acts?
Oh, yes, they did, because sometimes they were very kind. Sometimes the odd Japanese guard would give you a sweetmeat. Sometimes they would show you pictures of their family. They were especially understanding to children. It sounds unbelievable, but they were. And you just started up conversations. In the end, the impression that you receive is that they were, in the main, not very happy with what they were doing, but had to do what they did. And the fact also that it wasn't so much the Japanese who did the punishing, it was the Koreans, because they had some Koreans there, and they were perhaps not the easiest people to deal with, but there were certainly acts of kindness on the part of the Japanese. I mean, if this Japanese gentleman hadn't come around and said to Mum, I'll arrange for you to go to the hospital, hadn't intervened, I would not be alive today. So all right, some might call it timing, but he didn't have to do it. He could have just ignored the...